Hello, everyone. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Scott Bland. Coming up this week, we check in with some Politico White House reporters to see what's been going on at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and in the White House's relationship with the rest of its administration. And we're going to take a look at the special relationship between President Trump and a certain higher power. Plus, Democrats can't seem to find the candidates they want to run for Senate in the last week or two. Could this be a problem for them? We've got one of our congressional campaign reporters coming on to explain. Just a heads up before we get going, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, May 2nd, so it's all up to date as of then. All right, I want to welcome in two of our White House reporters this week, Nancy Cook. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Andrew Rastuccia. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, good, good. Thank you so much for coming in. And back in the studio after a brief hiatus, fortunately, senior politics editor Charlie Mutesian. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Scott. Good to be back.
Welcome back. All right, let's get started. Here are our first data points, 5 and 0. 5 hours was how long Attorney General William Barr spent testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, taking a lot of heat from Democrats about discrepancies between the Mueller report and the letter he wrote to them about the Mueller report before it was released in full. And then 0 is the amount of time he spent testifying to the House Judiciary Committee today. He was scheduled to testify. He was a no-show, argument over whether he would be questioned by members of Congress or staff attorneys was at the center of it all. But it gets back to this theme that we've now covered in a few recent episodes of the Nerdcast, right, Andrew, of the White House and the administration really resisting and going to great lengths to resist oversight. And this is just a new twist in the saga.
Yeah, I mean, the basic message from Barr is I gave you my 5 hours. I've said everything I'm going to say, and I'm done. And that's been the White House's, as you said, general approach here on everything from document requests to testimony. They're not allowing Stephen Miller to testify before Congress. They basically said, you know, we'll consider some of your document requests, but overall, we're not going to be forking over documents because they think it's a fishing expedition. And they've drawn a pretty hard line in the sand at this point.
Well, what's so fascinating to me is that they are basically completely undermining a key part of Congress's job, which is this oversight. That's what, you know, when the Republicans had the House, when Obama was president, you know, they investigated what happened in Benghazi when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State very aggressively. They investigated what happened with the IRS when there was an Obama appointee in there. So Republicans really have used this power when they control the House. But now, they're really trying to undermine the Democrats' ability to do it. And they're trying to say that the reason that they're not complying with these requests is intent. So like they're saying, we're not going to give Trump's tax returns because the request is politically motivated. That has never been an argument before. You know, this is just something that happens. You know, Congress has this oversight power. They can request these things. That's just the way it's always been. And Trump, just as he has broken the norms of a lot of things in the presidency, he's breaking the norms of these oversight proceedings by basically saying, well, the intent is bad, so therefore I don't have to comply. And that's a whole new argument that we've never seen before.
And there's always been this sort of effort by the executive to slow walk these requests, right? You know, thinking back to Solyndra or Fast and Furious or, you know, all these things, they weren't happy about complying with them. But in some cases, with a few exceptions, they usually eventually comply. And, you know, then there's a fight over what's redacted and what's not. But this is totally different, right? Because it's just a blanket NO from the White House in many cases.
I think it also reflects, to reiterate what Nancy said, a total disregard for the functions of government. And what I mean by that is what's unique about Trump is he had no government experience when he came in. Many of the people that are closest to him had no government experience. And when I say no government experience, I mean none at all. And we always talk about what happens if you were to put a business person in government or things like that. Well, we're getting a look at it intensified by about 1,000 times. The people we have elected to the presidency have all come through the system in one way or another, whether it was City Hall or state legislature or Congress or the Senate or the governorship. All of them at least developed a basic respect for the norms, the values, the systems that have developed over a couple of hundred years. Trump doesn't. And not only that, went into the the enterprise of being president with an absolute disregard and a disrespect for anyone involved with it. And this is what happens at the end of the day, is that you get an absolute screw you when Congress tries to exercise its own legislative prerogatives.
So here's what I'm wondering. The last time we talked about this, we talked, okay, where does this go from here? And we talked a lot about the courts and how long those fights tend to take. But it seems like this situation with Bill Barr, the attorney general, might be heading in a slightly different direction. And I say that because there's a story on the front page of Politico's website right now that says House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, in a closed-door caucus meeting among House Democrats yesterday, said that Barr lied to Congress and committed a crime in so doing last month. In previous testimony about the Mueller report and the drafting of it and the release of it, as Democrats have probed that whole process. So could this be going in a whole new and different direction with Barr specifically? I mean, if Pelosi's saying that, presumably just talking about it isn't what's on her mind.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like the House Democrats and Pelosi in particular has been so nervous about sort of being too aggressive with Trump and calling for impeachment. But after the Barr testimony yesterday, it seemed like there were a bunch of Democrats, both House Democrats and then Democrats who are in the Senate running for 2020, like Kamala Harris, who said Barr needs to resign. And that seems to be something that is an aggressive ask that they can coalesce behind right now. And Barr, if you watch the testimony, really exhibited sort of a, F you, I don't care attitude. He was pretty low energy, as Trump may call it, although Trump loves him. And really did not seem super riled up by like these questions about if he had misled them. It was sort of this like nonchalant, I'm not even going to get worked up about this attitude, which I think further enraged the Democrats.
And I think it politically, it may be easier for all the Democrats running for president and Democrats in Congress to train their anger on Barr and avoid the broader question of impeachment for the time being, and rush to call for his resignation and make the case that this attorney general, who's supposed to be an independent figure and is supposed to be separate from the White House, is not that at all.
I mean, they could try to impeach him if they wanted to.
They
right?
could try. Yeah. I don't think. I haven't seen anyone
that would be a plot twist.
Taking that next step, but that's it. You know, that may be the undercurrent of what Pelosi's saying. I'd be surprised if they went that route.
On the subject of Barr, I've got to ask you guys this question because I'm dying to know. I want to know what everybody makes of Barr, because I mean, to me, when you take a look at the figures in the Trump administration, whether they're working for him or the Republican politicians that are reacting to him, you can always, if you look close enough, understand their angle or the play. They're either ideologically MAGA, meaning they want to blow up the system, they don't care, or they're fearful and don't want to get primaried, but you can always understand what their political motivation is. Barr is a really curious figure because ideologically he's not in line with Trumpism. He did not. He owes nothing to Trump. He's more of an establishment conservative. He is not a political player in the sense that he needs to get elected. I would have expected something, or at least I expected something entirely different from him, not just in his comportment in the hearings yesterday, but also in the release of the report and sort of his behavior at every single juncture is fascinating to me. And I mean, clearly he's somebody who has an affinity for the exercise of executive power, but like you guys know him much better than I do. I'd love to hear people's take on that.
Well, I think that our colleague Eliana Johnson, who covers the White House with us, had a very nice piece on Barr and his motivations just ahead of the testimony on Wednesday. And basically what she found in the course of reporting that is that Barr, he worked in the Bush administration at the Department of Justice, and he really he's not a Trump person. He's not in that vein at all, but he really is motivated by the idea of executive power, which was a big theme in the Bush White House as well. There was this great quote in the piece saying he's like the Cheney of the Trump administration, just in terms of someone who understands sort of the raw exercise of power and trying to make executive power as broad as possible. And I think that that is what Barr believes in. What's interesting is that President Trump, I think, had some skepticism about whether Barr would be able to fill that role initially or be able to do what Trump wanted him to do. Now Trump loves Barr. I mean, Barr is basically what Jeff Sessions could never be to Trump. Trump has been so pleased by Barr's performance. You know, we saw Kellyanne Conway, a top advisor in the Trump administration, yesterday speaking with White House reporters, you know, trying to shame them for calling into question Barr, saying that he should command more respect for the attorney general. So it's this interesting marriage because I don't think Barr was like a Trumpian person, but he delivered what Trump wanted, and now Trump's his biggest fan.
And he was a reluctant attorney general, mm-hmm. which is one of the other notable elements of Eliano's great story. I think three times he'd been sort of recruited to come in the administration.
See, that's remarkable for someone who was apparently reluctant to take the job. He's dived into Trump's vision for it with extreme zest for the
But that's what ends up happening with a lot of top officials we've seen. You know, they may come in with their own set of ideology or their own way of doing things, and the Trump vortex for you know, some reason always really sucks people up, and they end up a lot of times people end up do really mirroring Trump's behavior in certain ways, or sort of ending up feeling persecuted the way he does. You've seen it time and time again.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's this bunker type mentality when you're in this administration, and I've heard this from so many people as you mm-hmm. talk to them, especially even after they've left. I mean, before you come in, you don't realize the sort of degree of incoming that you're receiving all the time. And then once you're in the building, and this isn't to excuse anybody's behavior, right? But once you're in the building, there's this sense of like, oh, I didn't realize this is what it would be like. And a sort of sense of camaraderie. I can't get it in Bill Barr's head. None of us can, right? But that could be one element of it here.
Well, if nothing else, he's brought the word snitty back into fashion. Right. I give him credit for that.
Andrew, I feel like this actually segues nicely into a story you wrote this week as we're talking about reluctant allies turned fierce allies of President Donald Trump. And the story, the headline of it was The Sanctification of Donald Trump. And it was about the rhetoric of Trump advisors and allies of seeing him literally as a godsend. And then you went from there into parsing Trump's relationship with his evangelical base, which I think, you know, certainly was an unlikely marriage if you look back to 2016 and the primaries. But it's now obviously a key core part of his presidency and his support.
Yeah, I mean, this story came about because the president's campaign manager, Brad Parscale, tweeted, and I'll read the tweet. He tweeted this on Tuesday. There has never been and probably never will be a movement like this again. Only God could deliver such a savior to our nation, and only God could allow me to help. God bless America. And, you know, this struck not just us as political reporters, but people around the president as an odd thing to say. I mean, he's basically making the case that God sent Trump to, you know, save this country. Not basically, literally. That's what he's saying. And, you know, I talked to a bunch of people for this story, including some, you know, really avowed backers of the president, Jerry Falwell Jr. in particular, who felt that this was a bridge too far. And Jerry Falwell Jr. notably has made excuses for the president's behavior in the past. In the aftermath of the Access Hollywood fiasco, he basically said, you know, I'm sticking with the president. And he's done that as he's been asked about the allegations of marital infidelity as well. But he felt like this was a little bit of a line for him, because his argument is basically, if you're going to give credit to God for the good presidents, then you have to blame God for the bad ones. And that would imply fallibility, and, you know, people don't want to go down that road. So I was really surprised that he pushed back. But this all aligns with the National Day of Prayer, which is today, Thursday, when we're taping this. The president hosted an event in the White House today, and he hosted an event last night where more than 100 or almost 200 faith leaders from all different denominations and different faiths kind of gathered in the White House for an event. But yeah, he has, despite that, maintained a swell of evangelical support. And the argument they make basically is, we like his policies and we're able to separate his policies from the man himself.
There was an interesting quote here in your story from presidential historian Timothy Natale, which said that there's a political argument, he thinks, behind these statements, and that basically what Trump's political lieutenants are saying is that what these political lieutenants are saying to the faithful is that you have no choice. God has told you how you must vote, and that there's kind of a rally mentality behind what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cynical reading of this, right? Is it's not just an offhanded comment, but it's an effort to say, if you are a God-fearing person, if you are a faithful person, that you have no choice but to vote for President Donald Trump because he is God's pick. He has the biggest endorsement there is, and that's from God himself. And that goes to the very core of the founding fathers' desire to separate church and state, right? And that gets into some really tricky territory if indeed that is the intent. And the other part of it is whether it's the intent or not, it could certainly be read that way. And this isn't just the campaign manager saying this. The White House press secretary has said that God wanted Trump to be president. Mike Pompeo, suggested that it was possible that Trump was elected to basically save the Jewish people from the threat of Iran. This threat has been repeated time and time again, and it's unusual. We haven't seen anything quite like it. I mean, there's always been an undercurrent of religion, dating back years and years in politics, but this is a little bit different.
Well, it's just another instance, I think, of Trump just completely changing the office of the presidency and changing something that had been separate before, mm-hmm. And sort of bringing that into the fold.
And I think the irony here, of course, is that the president himself, by most accounts, isn't a particularly religious man. I mean, he doesn't regularly attend church services. There has been, there has been some reporting of him, seeing a pastor occasionally in the White House. But, he isn't your classic,
His life is not built on faith.
Exactly. That's maybe the best way to put it.
And enough so that, as you point out, these statements do cause a little bit of consternation even among evangelical allies of his. It's a really interesting story. People should check it out. The headline is The Sanctification of Donald Trump. And this was a great segment, guys. Thank you so much for coming in. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
And thanks, Nancy.
Of course, anytime.
Charlie Mutessian is sticking around for the second segment, and we are joined for that second segment by James Arkin, our Senate campaigns reporter. Hi, James.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
Welcome to the studio. All right. Our data point for segment two is 3. That's the number of net seats that Democrats need to flip in order to take the Senate majority in 2020 if a Democrat is elected president. It's got to be 4 if they don't take the presidency, because then you don't have the vice president to break a 50-50 tie. Anyway, the point of this is that however many seats you need to flip, you have to have the candidates to do it. And right now, at this moment, Democrats are having a little trouble getting some of the candidates they really want in some of these tough states that are up in 2020 to run for Senate. And James has been reporting all about it. So, James, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you've been watching in the last week as we are gearing up for these 2020 Senate campaigns?
Yeah, the big news of the week was Stacey Abrams in Georgia declined to run for Senate. And there's no other way to put it. It was a big blow for Chuck Schumer and for Senate Democrats. I mean, the recruitment of Abrams had been sort of the most public and intense recruitment of a Senate candidate I've ever seen. Multiple meetings with Schumer. A lot of his allies were reaching out. He was talking to the press about how much he wanted Abrams to run, how much he thought she would be a good senator. Democrats really thought that she could put Georgia on the map in a way that no other candidate can. They still think that they can be competitive there, but she would have raised a ton of money. She would have gotten a ton of attention. She would not need to worry about name ID. Everyone knows who Stacey Abrams is at this point. She would have just made Georgia a battleground race in a way that no other Democrat can. And so it's a really big blow. And I mean, you think about more broadly, look at some of the candidates who are running for president who could have been Senate candidates. Democrats right now could have a Senate class that's Beto O'Rourke in Texas, former Governor John Hickenlooper in Colorado, Governor Steve Bullock in Montana, and Stacey Abrams in Georgia. That would be an A-plus Senate class, and none of those candidates are running.
Instead, you've got 3 of them running for president, and Stacey Abrams says she's considering it.
Yeah, exactly. So, whether they thought that they really stood a better chance of, being the one out of 21 now to become the Democratic nominee for president versus winning Senate, it's a big problem for Democrats. They're having to turn elsewhere for candidates.
There was a great quote in your story, James, from Adam Gentleson, who used to be a top staffer for Harry Reid when he was Senate Majority Leader, then Senate Minority Leader, talking about what a crappy job being a senator is. And the quote is something to the effect of basically, like, what are you going to tell these people, what are you going to sell them on when you're trying to get them to run for Senate? Like, come here and have Mitch McConnell steal your lunch money every day for 6 years?
Yeah, it's It's an interesting point from Jenelson, who's experienced both sides of the coin on being in the majority and the minority in the Senate. And I mean, if Democrats can't flip it, regardless of whether they keep the House and win the presidency, if they're still in the Senate minority, now Mitch McConnell's just going to continue to, you know, block Democratic priorities. He's going to continue to push judges through, you know, all these things that Democrats, there's really nothing they can do in the minority at this point to stop Mitch McConnell. And, you know, Chuck Schumer has obviously used that as a recruitment tool to talk about the importance of needing the Senate. But it seems it just hasn't quite worked. Senate Democrats haven't really figured out how to convince people that they have a shot at the majority if they can get these candidates to run, and that these candidates could be, you know, central to flipping it back.
Can I offer a contrarian take, though?
Always.
Because I don't really understand the Democratic obsession with worshiping at the altar of failed, unsuccessful candidates. and this is not to denigrate or take anything away from Stacey Abrams or anyone else, but Democrats have fixed on these candidates who lost in what was otherwise a great Democratic year as somehow their only path to winning back the majority. And that's not necessarily true. Stacey Abrams, clearly a gifted politician. We'll see big things from her over the course of her career because she's so young. Beto O'Rourke, again, a talented politician, but Beto O'Rourke, Stacey Abrams, MJ Hagar. The party is affixing their attention to these candidates who lost in what was a great Democratic year. That doesn't necessarily make them the most outstanding candidates and the only ones who can win those seats. I still think there are many other candidates out there for them, even though it's early. And also, I would add that the idea that these people like Bullock and Hickenlooper aren't going to run is I won't use the expletive. I'm not saying both of them will run. I'm not saying one of them will run. But all of these 2020 candidates who the DS tried to get to run for Senate seats that say, I'm not running for Senate, they will be back. There will be a second round after they drop out and run out of money in the presidential race and are floundering in under 1% and are looking down the barrel of the rest of their life without a spot in government, without a spot in the spotlight. And when they're thrown all sorts of inducements to run for Senate, one or more of them is going to run for Senate. Because just because they said no now doesn't mean anything. The filing deadlines are next year.
Yeah, it's a very fair point. And I mean, they're hopeful that might happen, especially with Bullock, who really is sort of the only Democrat who's thought to be able to put Montana in the battleground category for Senate races. You know, it's sort of Bullock or nothing there for them. And with Abrams, it's a really fair point. Some Democrats think that she sort of maxed out her support in the state in her losing gubernatorial race in 2018. I mean, she's known universally in the state. She lost by about a point and a half. It would have been tough to increase her support. And so in some ways, Democrats, there are some who may think maybe we're better off with someone new who can sort of gain new supporters who just wouldn't have been persuadable for Stacey Abrams.
James, take us through a little bit of the map here and some of the key states that we're thinking about. And I mean, along the way, we're going to run into some candidates. It's not all bad news for Democrats here. They've had a little bit of a dry run trying to get some of these candidates in lately, but they've got Mark Kelly in Arizona, the former astronaut who they've been trying to get to run for something for like a bajillion years.
Yeah. I mean, Arizona is like top of the list. Mark Kelly is sort of the highlight recruit for Democrats, and he's absolutely made Arizona competitive again right after they just won in Arizona last year against the same Republican who they're going to be running against, Martha McSally, who was appointed to the seat. So Arizona's top of the list. Colorado's right up there with Arizona. Cory Gardner won sort of narrowly in 2014 in the best Republican year in memory. Colorado has gotten even more blue since then. They got a pretty crowded field of Democratic candidates there.
It speaks to the opportunity they think
exactly.
They see, right?
I mean, the thing about it is it's a crowded field, but it's a crowded field of people, you know, former U.S. attorney, a former Obama administration official at the State Department, you know, some candidates who have run statewide before. There are some potentially impressive candidates there. Democrats are not worried about Colorado. They're going to be competitive. But then it gets tougher after those two. You know, Maine is a blue state, but Susan Collins is going to be tough. There's no two ways about it. Democrats think she's lost some support back home since she voted for Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, but that remains to be seen whether they can be competitive there or not. And then you have North Carolina, Georgia, Iowa, you know, some red-ish states where really for Democrats, I think it's going to come down to can they get good candidates and can their presidential nominee be competitive in those states? You know, if Donald Trump cleans up in North Carolina and Iowa, I don't think Democrats are going to be able to win Senate races there. If their presidential nominee is within a point or two or wins those states, I think Democrats have a really good shot. And so that's where it comes down to recruitment. You need someone who can raise the money, who can be competitive, and then sort of take advantage of the political environment at the top of the ticket at the end of the day.
And then one key Senate race that we didn't mention because it's potentially competitive in the other direction in 2020 is Alabama. It was the site of that incredible, bizarre, once-in-a-lifetime special election victory in 2017 where Doug Jones, Democrat, beat Roy Moore, the Republican, in the wake of all that reporting by the Washington Post and others about Moore's relationships with young girls back when he was a younger man but still an adult man. And now Jones is going to be running for re-election in 2020 as a Democrat in Alabama with Donald Trump on the ballot. And presumably he'll have a much tougher time, maybe unless Roy Moore runs again.
I was going to say, you said it's a once-in-a-lifetime special election, but rumors abound that Roy Moore is absolutely considering running again. He continues to feel that that election was stolen from him, and I think some of his supporters in Alabama feel the same way.
Never conceded, right?
Never conceded, no, and has sent out fundraising emails suggesting that he's seriously considering running again. Now, whether he can win a primary against other Republicans remains to be seen. Republicans think that as long as Roy Moore is not their nominee, they're going to be able to beat Doug Jones in Alabama. And that makes the map just that much tougher for Democrats. But you never know. If we have a rematch, Roy Moore versus Doug Jones in 2017, all bets are off. We'll see where it goes from there.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye out for that. James, thank you so much for coming in to roll us through it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you for being here.
I feel a little underdressed next to James.
James is coming from the Hill. He's a fancy man.
Oh, I thought maybe you were on TV or something.
Got to impress all the lawmakers.
I'm impressed.
And as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners. We're going to turn things over right now to one of those listeners to read the credits this week. Diane Lee in Massachusetts is going to help us out.
Nerdcast is produced by Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Diane. Listeners, if you are a Nerdcast fan who would like to read the credits, shoot us an email at nerdcast@politico.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.